From Little Rock, Arkansas, that's Pharoah Sanders with Equinox, composed, as it turns out, and first recorded by John Coltrane in 1960. It's from his 1987 album, O Lord, Let Me Do No Wrong. Sanders began his professional career playing tenor sax and rhythm and blues bands in Oakland, California, but New York City's avant-garde jazz world beckoned him in 1961, and he soon found himself among some of the leaders of the burgeoning jazz movement, including Sun Ra and John Coltrane. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and of course, it's the day after the Michigan mashup. And we'll be talking about that and other political anomalies as we go. But what's significant about yesterday's victory for Bernie Sanders in Michigan is that the coverage is telling us that it has to do with just, you know, the sheer force of voter turnout and so forth. And we know, as we've been discussing here on this program, that it is much more than that. And actually, every time we talk about this race, we seem not to talk about race, and yet we talk about race. You know, the analyses have to do with, well, the strategy and, the different constituencies and so forth. But bottom line is that as much as the country does to hide or to avoid talking about issues concerning race in America, this entire presidential contest is all about race. All about it. And this is a really interesting thing, how we know it's there. We know it is a factor there. We know it is the most important factor in political outcomes. But they talk about it almost in a football game. You're covering a kind of contest where it's just an element, that's all. It's not really linked to anything, and we shouldn't place more significance on it than anything. We should just regard it as, this is how it is. This is just the way it is. But in fact, this is America's story. No other country in the world, I think, engages in such total denial that we are a race-based society. And when it comes to politics, when it comes to the presidential race especially, it is right there in the open, and yet all the rest of the year, it really isn't a big deal. It isn't a major factor. But of course it is. Why is that? It is so pivotal here. It could not be the case that Hillary Clinton has a candidacy to speak of. She would have absolutely no candidacy to speak of had it not been for the fact that she has, again, what she, in my view, pejoratively calls her firewall. This is her version of a compliment. But she is saying, I am sure that I've got the blacks. They belong to me. I got them. Now, would anybody dare suggest that Hillary Clinton is playing the race card? Would anybody dare suggest that Ted Cruz or Donald Trump and these folks are playing the race card? In large measure, what we're talking about in America is race, the fear of the others by virtue of their racial designation, their cultural designation, which is race. Bernie Sanders even is talking about class in order to avoid talking about race. He was not really enthusiastic about talking about race head on until forced to. And now he sees the wisdom of it because this is racial politics. This is American apartheid politics. And it has been denatured conveniently. It has been neutered a bit. It has been neutralized to be acceptable to talk about it as, you know, part of political strategy. But we are talking about race, no question about it. Who is going to own the Hispanic vote? Who is going to own the black vote? Who's going to own the Asian vote? And suddenly we come to the realization that even as we are encouraged to ignore race, it is a permanent thread in the fabric of American life. And a lot hinges on it. Now, this is really incredible to me because it is denial of a supreme order. You know, it's just like we talk about race, or we choose to talk about race in the sense of diversity, in the positive sense. Even when we cite the downside of race, in terms of race being a very important instrument in the propagation and maintenance of white supremacy, we still manage to have the conversation twisted so that it is done with a sense of benevolence. There is a recognition that racism, as it's called, racism, it's really not discussed as what it really is. It's race oppression. Racial oppression. And it is said and discussed in terms of what we have to do in a rehabilitative kind of uplifting way, as if there's really a genuine effort to get rid of it. But of course, it is so important to maintain it. It is not going to be gotten rid of at all. It is vital to the maintenance of white supremacy in our culture. That is the culture of America. It was designed and maintained in all these different ways, but it is essential to the continuation of the dominant culture. So it is not going to go away. Racial superiority and racial dominance of the others. That's not going away. We hear talk about it in times like this when we have these elections and suddenly everybody becomes magnanimous and they become, of course, patronizingly so. We have people suddenly talking about what they have to do and how they're going to address the problems of the, you know, they use different names. It could be the underclass or poverty, which is to say they're talking about the same people that everybody recognizes are the dominated group or groups. But we're clear. We are still seeing the world in this two-dimensional way where it is you either belong to the group that dominates or you belong to the group dominated. And all the other things are thrown in into the mix, and you add to that a lot of deception, propaganda, outright lies, and misdirection to achieve the cosmetic objective of creating a society where people are relatively equal. That too is a joke. It doesn't happen, and it's not going to happen anytime soon. But we do have the ongoing narrative of how do you maintain this order? How do you maintain an acceptance of this order where one group, it's called, European, or the group of elites, the European group has expanded its definition of whiteness, which is what we are witnessing. The expansion of whiteness has to occur from time to time in order to maintain a numerical advantage and to assure continuity, racial continuity. This is very important. I have remarked on this program many times that many of the people running today as candidates for president of the United States themselves would have been disqualified from even trying because they were not considered white and or certainly not white enough to be white in America. Most of the candidates running today are from backgrounds that were considered very undesirable culturally not too long ago. So their white skin, which is in this culture of skin privilege, their white skin didn't even afford them the privileges of whiteness in America. Because, for example, in the case of Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio, you had the wrong surname. John Kasich would never have been considered a good white person in America not too long ago. Hillary Clinton certainly would not have qualified as a white person in America not too long ago. So all candidates running have in one way or the other understood the transition that the country is making. Donald Trump, I talked about, would never have been considered a white person not too long ago. Not according to the standard definition of whiteness in America. So we have the strange anomaly that we have a new generation recently whose cultural groups recently, I'm talking in historical terms now, very recently were admitted to the world of whiteness as whiteness has been defined historically in the United States. And even those like Ben Carson and Barack Obama before him, who were vying for this the highest prize, had to acknowledge, publicly acknowledge, and had to genuflect before the rules of whiteness to sufficiently expunge the African roots to say, I accept the fact that I'm special. I'm what used to be called, it's so different. You're a different kind of black person, which means you recognize and you have done some work to indicate that you acknowledge as your constant guide, as your own reference point, the values, quote unquote, American, white America's, white supremacist America's values. It's fascinating. So in this time, when we're talking about the elections and we see that piece of the puzzle understood, it is understood by the candidates and it is understood by the various constituencies those candidates appeal to. Now, I'm going here to Hillary and Sanders, that contest, and how the racial element is expressed in the contest between them. As white people now in America, because Sanders, although he is Polish and Jewish, which, again, not too long ago would have been two strikes against him, he has acceptably been positioned within white America. He's acceptable. It's his ideology that people are having problems with. And that, by the way, it's not being discussed in the open, but that is what white America has a problem with him about. And that is where they begin to understand and accept him, not just as a white guy. He is now suddenly a radical Jew. He comes from that radical Jewish background. And there's a secret group out there that they haven't yet let that go, that the radicals in the early part of the 21st century and certainly the latter part of the 19th and 20th centuries, we had a lot of Jewish radicals. Certainly from the 60s, they will only go back to the 60s. Say, well, let's go back to the 60s, and that's where he comes out of, being uncomfortably close, too close, culturally too close to blacks. And perhaps this is why Sanders took a long time to actively voice an alliance with blacks and missed out. Hillary Clinton, on the other hand, comes from a different school of thought. She comes from that old school of thought, the old white supremacist school of thought, that pretty much was like that of the plantation. You accept the notion that you're superior. And it is the duty of blacks to support you. You're entitled to it. And just like on the plantation, you have blacks whose job it is to keep other blacks in check. They maintain the discipline that you wish enforced among other blacks, for your interest and your safety, your sense of accomplishment, your control. That's a very incredible difference between the outlook of a Bernie Sanders and the outlook of a Hillary Clinton. Bernie Sanders comes from an oppressed group. He speaks about it, not often enough, but he talks about his people, most of his generation back then, wiped out in the Holocaust. He talks about the persecution. So he identifies with oppression as a person close to oppression in his own life. Hillary Clinton does not. Hillary Clinton identifies with the oppressor. And so it is understandable that she feels so comfortable sending out these black ambassadors and missionaries, send them out to the plantation to tell people what they have to do. And they obey. They obey. The black community so far has literally salvaged Hillary Clinton, has literally made of her a legitimate candidate. She would not have had that if she depended strictly on the white world. It would not have happened. So I'm talking about these two candidates because they're very fascinating in the way they both incorporate and distance themselves from when they, you know, the notion of the role of race in the society and how they deal with it. And in, by extension, how the rest of us deal with it. What is the message that they're sending? Bernie Sanders was very uncomfortable at the beginning of his run to talk openly about it, because it would have forced him to go back to that place where he would have had to kind of yield or disavow or give up some of the benefits of being finally incorporated into the white world. And the interesting thing is, as it is playing out in these races, Bernie's base is largely white, and Hillary's base is largely black. Isn't that odd? It's not if you break it down. These two candidates understand specific things about race in America. Well, we know about the Republicans. We'll get to them another day. I'm talking to the question of Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders dynamic and race in America. And why it is imperative, I think, and this is what Bernie Sanders can do, and I think he's beginning to get that message. He need not be afraid. Hillary Clinton is still patronizing and sanctimonious and a total fraud when it comes to being genuine about wanting true equality in America. That's not, it's stuff she says. It has no meaning whatsoever. But we look at the fact that the people who do not realize this, the people are the very ones supporting her to the tune almost of 90% of black voters. What accounts for that? Why would you have such a phenomenon when it's so patently clear that the woman is a total fraud? What accounts for that? I take you back to the point I made earlier about the plantation society. That's the marker, and that's the attitude. These people who are coming to the African-American community in her name, and she, of course, has been traversing the African-American community because she has no place else to go. She has no other place to go for a predetermined, overwhelming support. And this is largely because the people that she's appealing to are psychologically, they've been done in. And they have the problem of being disconnected from their history, which is part of being done in. They believe and have been conditioned to believe that voting is how you know, it's the ultimate expression of power, and it isn't. You don't get very much really from voting. And we have been discussing here the rigged process that it is. You may be voting, but you're not going to get the people that you vote for. Somebody else, they have a system of checks and balances against your will. The Democratic Party has a very elaborate system that could deliver results that you and did not want and did not vote for. But they have a way of engineering an outcome. We know, even as we speak, it has already been arranged that Hillary Clinton is going to be the nominee. Something dramatic, really dramatic, has to happen to have that process not go through. Because she is being supported by that system of supremacy. And that system of supremacy has as its number one priority maintenance of supremacy. Never mind the liberal label. Never mind this business of, I marched in the civil rights movement and my husband plays the saxophone. So we are black. I eat collard greens when I go to Sylvia's in New York City. And I know some of my best friends are black. All of that stuff means nothing. She's dedicated. That is the element that we have had to deal with for a long time. People who are specific about the maintenance and propagation of white supremacy. Hillary Clinton is one of them. The people who are brought into the process are just kindling. They just, light them and they start the fire. And then it warms a whole bunch of people, not them. They're burned up. They become ashes and they're discarded afterwards. But this is the problem. We do not understand as a people, and I'm including here forward-thinking people of all kinds, because history also tells us that we have, not too many, I grant you that, but we have had the historical record reflect that many people of all kinds stood up to oppression and paid with their lives. John Brown, for example. Granted, it is not enough. It is not pervasive. It's not a pervasive way of that people are thinking, because the privileges that accrue with white supremacy are so attractive. They're so good that people are willing to part ways with principle, with justice, with just plain common sense, with humanity, in order to enjoy these goodies. Now, I ask you, what would you say? How could Hillary Clinton, in the real world, this is now addressing the dementia of the African-American sector that consistently is called upon to support Hillary Clinton and is obeying, apparently, because they continue to account for an inordinate percentage of the vote for her. What exactly can be pointed to as a major accomplishment and contribution by Hillary Clinton to the African American community? What is it? I haven't heard of her experiences, how she went to so many countries and did this and she participated in that. But I am looking for somebody to tell me concretely what she has delivered. What has Bill Clinton absolutely delivered to the African-American community in the United States? Other than misery and poverty and denial of opportunity and all the things that they sing about, what have they done? And worse, these leaders that they're sending out and who are taking up the cause to convert their communities into bundles of kindling, to just warm up this candidate and warm up this party. How could they, in good conscience, Well, I guess that was my answer. They don't have a conscience. They no longer do. And that tells us, once again, we're on a plantation system. We have not left the plantation. We have not left it psychologically, and we have not left it physically. We're still on the plantation. This is a time to clean house. This is a time to punish a party that has no intention of changing its evil ways. It is of no use. It is of no use to anybody who is progressive. The party, in fact, has a lot to account for the retardation of progress. And worse, the outright canceling of progress. It has stood in the way of progress. It has prevented progress. It has, in fact, been an oppressive party. Well, look, Barack Obama was president. He's a black guy. What is your trouble? How could you say a thing like that? You look at the bottom line. This president signed on early to white supremacy and aided and abetted it. His policies have been retrograde. The people he has had chosen to be on the cabinet level have done so much damage, not just here, but all around the black world. Education is important, yes, because his daughters will go to very fine schools. But what is happening in Chicago, where he comes from? What is happening to the schools there? What happened to all of the public schools in Louisiana? In I should say, New Orleans, Louisiana. What is happening to the schools in Detroit and New York City and Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., where his, quote-unquote, his people, unquote, are? What is happening to the young people who are graduating, cutting out of college, who can't get a job? Teenage unemployment in some cases as high as in the 80 percentile. This is insane. Black adult unemployment routinely twice that of the national average, and worse now than in some cases than it was in the midst of the Depression of the 1920s. You're talking about loss, massive loss of wealth. Blacks losing their homes, or being charged way above what they ought to be to get a mortgage. The quality of life, despite the fact that they're paying inordinately higher rates than millionaires. The police are an occupying military force. All of this is happening under a black president. And a Democratic Party. But you could show up in Flint, using it, of course, as a suffering and poisoning of tens of thousands of people in a city, which has been a write-off and is being treated as such. You can do all of that because it looks good, not because you have any particular sense of outrage and identification with people whose children are suffering. You're real clear. Your child isn't suffering, and your granddaughter will not suffer, not like the average person in Flint. And your ambassadors are coming forward and invading your sacred places, your churches, with a message that Hillary Clinton is to be supported. And we know it is just the cosmetic part of a deal that has already been cut. Bernie Sanders might be winning the popular vote, but Hillary Clinton is leading with the superdelegates. You know, after all, we're talking here about a Clinton. They don't necessarily go by the book. So, when you have a group of people as a racially designated group who have gone through centuries of this kind of conditioning to literally think nothing or very little of themselves and what matters to them, they turn this negative energy inward so they don't see their communities as being important or that their schools are worth fighting for. They have little value. They don't see leadership within themselves, the power to change things within themselves. They look to the person oppressing them even for that. Hillary Clinton will come and save us, say, essentially, even the mothers of murdered children, murdered by police, endorsing Hillary. She will do something about this. You have to be out of your mind. You have to be out of your mind to think this. You have to pay attention to people who have called our attention to these kinds of anomalies. One of them is the late Amos Wilson, who I think was just such a brilliant person. And he put in writing, his book, Blueprint for Black Power, is something everybody should read. It's an extraordinary work. It is literally way too much book in one place. It's almost 1,000 pages. But he says something very incredible. He says, you tell me what major progress have black people made in this country as a result of voting? What radical transformation came about as a result of black people voting? And he asks, did you even vote to get the vote? It's a great question. Did you vote to get the vote? No. The answer still is as it always has been. You've got to get excited about your own situation. And you've got to do something about it. Voting hasn't done a thing, really. It theoretically could if we develop a kind of military strategy about how the vote is to be used and who it is to be used for and what it is to be used for and when it is to be used. But real progress, the struggle for freedom and liberation in this country never involved the vote. It was always about people taking direct action. This thing called a voting booth, it's really like a jail cell. You go in there and you're playing a game. Or, more accurately, the game is being played on you. You vote, and then person A or person B gets into a position, and you're history. Only in very rare situations have we seen the kind of leadership that gave us reason to believe that there was actual power in the vote. But the vote has little value, to be truthful, to people who are oppressed. It could have value if we have a strategy about how it is to be used. We don't have a strategy. So it is useless. It is rendered useless. What is the strategy? What has been the strategy, let's say, with Hillary Clinton? What has been the strategy there? Vote for her because what? I don't get that. The vote is not what will get us liberation, freedom, fairness. It's not going to do any of those things. Because if you understand the racial history of the United States, if you're African American, you're Latino, you're a person who is non-white in this society, you understand where you are in the scheme of things. You are a member of the dominated class. And if you understand that, then you have to look to other things, not the thing devised by the system to maintain itself. You have to look outside of that to find ways in which your safety, your interests are safeguarded. That system is theirs. It works for them. They created it. They're maintaining it. It is their property. It is their way of operating, and they all agree that with this system, the number one objective, which is maintaining white society, white supremacy in the society, that is going to be achieved. Why would you want to fit into that? But if you are thinking in a strategic way, there is a way to understand the value of the vote and when to exercise it and with whom and for what. Clearly, do you have a choice? Do you cast your vote at all? Do you cast your vote with somebody who understands oppression and who has that at least in common with you? And I'm not here, I'm not plugging Bernie Sanders and saying he's the guy, but these are the choices you have to make. This is how you evaluate your situation. Do you cast your vote with somebody who still has you in mind as a field hand on the plantation and who has other overseers to keep you in check on the plantation? You will never leave it. You created this person by just blindly throwing this thing that you say you value called the vote. And the reason I go back again, just to remind you, I warned you about the importance and significance of South Carolina and of the rise of Jesse Jackson and the Rainbow Coalition. That was supposed to have been the point of departure from the plantation, the political plantation. And we saw, of course, being Jesse Jackson, who should today be the kingmaker or queenmaker, if you will, whose currency right now should be so high in his own community that he should be able to say, you know what, we're not voting this year for so-and-so. Instead, we're voting for so-and-so because A, B, C, D, and E. But he's co-opted. He's finished. He's highly suspect. He has no credibility because he handed over his own people to the plantation, the Democratic Party plantation. You can't look at a person like that and say, well, this person is somebody who really has our interests at heart. And we are not seeing the kind of education that ought to be occurring in our communities about just where we stand. An honest appraisal of where we stand and what it is that we need to do. And jumping back into the Democratic Party is not what we need to do, plain and simple. We have to build. We have to reconstruct. We have to go through another reconstruction. It's annoying because so much time and talent and effort and money and resources have already been squandered, and we go through these cycles time and again. And one of the reasons we go through these cycles is we refuse to punish people who betray us. We refuse to call them out. We refuse to point them out in public and publicly cancel whatever insurance policy they ever had with us. We refuse to say to people in the open, these are traitors. We regard them as such. We don't have any use for them. They're not with us. So therefore, they are against us. We are beyond them. They're no longer, we do not claim them anymore. And we do not believe that they ought to claim us either. We're done with them. And you move on. But you do the work of publicly denouncing them and calling them out because their aiding and abetting the system is an act of treachery. And people ought to start paying for these kinds of things. Get them out. Get them out of office. And let people know. But more importantly, construct something that will work. It's not going to be perfect. And you shouldn't worry about perfection. It's not never going to be achieved. It just has to be workable. And it just has to achieve a stated goal and objective. Our road forward isn't looking backward. We have to look backward at what people did with the incredibly few resources that they had, but with incredible determination and what they achieved, so that people today are able to do things that were unimaginable during their time. But we have definitely entered the cycle of self-annihilation, and we've got to stop it. We have to understand and appreciate. We don't want to encourage more racial, superiority and black inferiority and Latino inferiority. We don't want to be talking about this anymore. We want to end it. And the only way to end it is to get to the grindstone and start constructing your own systems that you control. And voting is not the number one answer at all. It isn't. Strategic voting is important. Voting itself isn't. So when we see these results and the pundits are telling us what they are and what they mean, just set all of that aside. And remember this, and this is the only thing you need to remember. Things have not changed. The basic power equation in this country remains almost exactly the same. And they will not change anytime soon, because the methods of control have been so effective. But that doesn't mean they can't change or won't change. It is up to us to decide to make the change occur. We have to implement it. We have to institute the change. And for strictly selfish reasons, survival and the fact that we are entitled to thrive. And that's it. There's nothing personal here. It's just business. This is business. We're taking care of business, and we have to come to that conclusion. We are taking care of business, not using your formula, because we know what that yields. It gets us nowhere. So we have to discard that. These things are of no value to us. You do an audit yourself and see whether you, as a member of any oppressed group, have benefited greatly from anything this system has devised. No. The power equation is exactly the same. The outcome, therefore, will be exactly the same. And if we are interested in continued survival, then we have to change our tactics and our behavior, our ways of thinking and doing things. This seems to me to be an opportune moment to bring that all together and to come to a point of resolution about finding ways outside of this formula, which will do us no good, to operate, to survive, to thrive. I want to thank you so much for joining me today and allowing me to vent, I call it. But these things need to be said because I think we fall into the malaise of having people doing the thinking for us. And of course, they hand us what they hand us, and we are supposed to go along with that program. But you should also understand by now, the battle is for your mind. And if they have your mind, the battle is lost to you. There's no way you could fight. You have your brain cells still working, so you have a chance. We have a shot. Let's take the opportune moment here and do something different. Stay tuned. Coming up next, the NDC Savings Club. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. I'd love to know what you think about this program. And always a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. I really mean that. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.